That's my music. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And I have Bradley Coates with me once again, a man with truly a progressive mind. He knows all about marriage and divorce, our topics for today, because he's a divorce lawyer in beautiful Honolulu, Hawaii. I used to live there, and that's where I first interviewed him with his first edition of Divorce with Decency in 1999. And he is the fifth edition is now available. The fifth edition of Divorce with Decency. Welcome back to this program, Brad Coates.
Hey, Diane. Always good to talk to you.
And thank
you. It is
you.
Indeed the fifth edition. I never would have believed that book would have gone through five different renditions from the University of Hawaii Press, but so it has.
Yeah. And it has, and it has because it helps a lot of people. And we're going to look at some statistics having to do with marriage and divorce. But of course, your book, while it has a lot of statistics, it's so much more. In fact, the subtitle of Divorce with Decency is The Complete How-To Handbook and Survivor's Guide to the Legal, Emotional, Economic, and Social Issues. So it's that you cover a lot. But we're going to look at some statistics about marriage rates, divorce rates, remarriage and divorce rates, kind of the highlights before we get into some of the main causes and risk factors for divorce. Can you give us some highlights, Brad Coates, on marriage rates, divorce rates, and remarriage and divorce rates?
Well, without going into too much detail, I mean, I think anybody who's been paying any attention at all over the last little bit has realized that the institution of marriage is on a serious and steep decline in modern day America. And then the question is, how does that, you know, ripple effect kind of spill over to, you know, what happens to nuclear families as we used to know them, and how kids are raised, and how people live their lives, and what kind of lifestyles come in to supplant it? I mean, it's a real game changer as far as, you know, the face of our nation's demography is entailed. And so it's just a question of trying to anticipate what some of these trends are going to, you know, are going to be like, and what they're going to do to society as we know it, or should I say as we used to know it, because it is going to be a new dawn.
A new dawn, and pick out one or two of the marriage rates in terms of the statistics you gathered, and maybe even the most recent ones that you must have accumulated for edition number 5 of your book, Divorce with Decency.
Well, just, you know, to cut to the chase, it's estimated there's been a 40% drop in marriage rate just since 1970. I mean, you and I, being sort of in the baby boom generation, a lot of us, you know, grew up in the 70s, got married in the 70s and 80s, got divorced in the 90s, whatever. But there's been a pattern where since the 1970s, marriage rate has dropped off by almost half. In 1972, 75% of all U.S. adults were married. I mean, oftentimes you married your high school or college girlfriend, and you know, oftentimes if you wanted to have sex, you had to get married. I mean, there were all kinds of strident, you know, sort of self-contained hallmarks of how society used to function. But you know, now, instead of 75% of all U.S. adults being married, according to the 2010 census, married couples are actually in the minority, comprising only about 48% of all U.S. households. So there are actually more unmarried American adults than there are married Americans. That
more,
in and of itself,
yes.
That in and of itself is a major shift.
For sure. And, you know, we have quite a few younger listeners who may be surprised to hear that there was a time in ancient history when you pretty much had to get married in order to have sex.
Thank God those days are over.
Well, yes. And as since I do a lot of marriage counseling in my practice, I see a lot of young couples who've had a pretty active sex life before they got married, and they still have sexual problems. Of course, since I specialize in human sexuality, they often present with that, but a lot of times they really have more communication problems, and we have to deal with those first before we get to their sex life. And in fact, the main one of the main causes and risk factors, and you highlight this, is lack of communication in a marriage.
That's especially important for women.
Yes, it is.
You know, there's basically four main, you know, fairly ascertainable causes of divorce. One is sex, which is your wheelhouse. The other is money. The other is family. When you think about money, you know, too little money in a, you know, some one of the couple loses their job, and that puts a strain on the family budget. And how long does the husband or wife want to continue to support their spouse, you know, if they're not working? You know, those kind of things can be a real problem for marriages. So too little money obviously can be a problem. Different earning capacity is a problem. Too much money can ironically be a problem. Sometimes people get a little cocky and they've got a lot of money. They start spending it on maybe things that they shouldn't be spending it on. You know, races, you know, snazzy cars, outside girlfriends, whatever. And that can be a problem. Family is kind of an obvious one. You're talking about, you know, maybe different approaches to parenting between the two spouses themselves, maybe not getting along with each other's in-laws. You know, all those kind of issues that can be a problematic. And certainly marriages that include children, although somewhat more rewarding oftentimes, and oftentimes, you know, more likely to stay together just for the children, if for no other reason, they still, when they can't stay together, the fact that, you know, the difference of opinion on kids, or in particular stepkids brought into a second marriage, you know, those are the big deal breakers in second marriages. So the family has a major impact as well. And then, of course, you know, the other one is sex, which, knowing you, we're going to be talking about. And and then the last one is interspousal communication. So the guys are, you know, scratching their heads going, you know, what do you mean, you know, communication? And that just shows how little they understand about, you know, how much women want communication as compared to maybe guys who, as long as they, you know, get their three meals a day and are sitting in their lazy boy lounger watching sports, you know, to them that's a good marriage. Whereas to the Wahinis, which is Hawaiian, of course, for women, you know, that can be a marriage that is past its expiration date, and maybe she's a little upset over that lack of communication issue.
Yeah, communication is so important, and as I said earlier, I oftentimes have to help the couple with communication. You know, if a couple has experienced cheating, lying, neglect, betrayal, then some of them would rather throw dishes at each other's heads than sit down for a fireside chat. So I have to help them get past that and calm down so that they can actually talk about it, give each other space and time to get a handle on hot emotions, right?
Well, it's always smart to let emotions cool down, and sometimes, you know, as both you and I know, but maybe your audience could stand a reminder, is that, you know, the lack of communication doesn't even have to be intense fighting communication. It stems really from, you know, what Dr. John Gray, the men are from Mars, women are from Venus guy, always, his theory was that the gender gap on communication stems from the fact that men and women have very different brain functions. And the telltale signal on that is that guys have been tracked using a mere 7,000 communication signals. And by communication signals, I'm talking about everything from actual verbal utterances to body language to whatever, but guys give off about 7,000 communication signals a day, which is only about a third of the over 20,000 communication signals that is the daily output for women. So women are just much more hardwired to communicate, and guys may not really even understand that they're supposed to be communicating. Like I say, it may not even be breaking dishes. It may just be that they're sitting there acting like slugs on their lazy boy lounger, which is almost equally irritating to the women.
I wanted to share with you, I recently read a rift on John Gray's title, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, and it's this: women are from stars, men are from penis.
I like that.
I do, too. I thought you would. Yes. Well, so differences that you've just described in men's and women's brains, and that accounts for some of the differences. I know how much you like John and actually his wife Julie Gottman, and I think I mentioned this before when talking to you on the air, but Brian, my fiancé, and I were comped to go to one of their sessions, which is they normally charge $700 for 2 days. And it was fascinating, of course. John Gottman has done 40 years of research, and they're based in Seattle here. They conducted a long-term study of 130 newlywed couples. And John Gottman is quoted as saying, the data shocked us. Two-thirds of new parents reported that they were very unhappy after the birth of their first child. So we'll get to that in a minute. But about communication, what the Gottmans did was they taped couples interacting in the lab, their so-called love lab, and what they found is, after the first child, that the couple treated one another with much more contempt, belligerence, and sadness, as well as with less affection and humor and empathy than did couples without children but married for the same amount of time. So they used a self-report measure of marital adjustment, and they found that over the next year, hostility between partners increased dramatically, while the romance dissolved. And 3 years later, there was little improvement. These statistics alone might make some couples think twice about having a child, but most do want to have a child, and I certainly would never turn my kids back. They're just wonderful human beings, and I'm so glad that I'm a mother. But there are some
troubling... You're not going to put them up on eBay for... Yeah.
Yeah, there are some troubling statistics, and this was a long-term study that the Gottmans did.
Well, it's funny that you should mention that. I mean, I've heard statistics where marital satisfaction drops off by 70% following the birth of a first child. That one's kind of a well-known statistic. There's no question, but what adding kids in. You know, so the child certainly, especially for the Wahine, the child becomes the central focus, and the guy who maybe was used to thinking that he was something of a central focus, he moves to second place, and a lot of times guys are not very comfortable with that transition. And like I say, a lot of times the women are not very happy with their husband's inability to deal with it. There's another thing in my book that, where Ann Landers, the advice columnist, she once asked the question of her readers, and I'm quoting, if you had it to do over again, would you have children? And she received 10,000 responses, and much to her dismay, 70% said no, which is
yes.
kind of amazing when you think about it.
Yes. Well, it's hard to be a good parent. It helps a lot. I realize this when I look back when my children were young, and now they're, of course, older people, like 37 and 40. So, but when my children were young, I was aware that it helped a lot that I had a good mother and a good father, and I had secure attachment. So I had good modeling. That helped a lot. And there was... a guy in the 50s, a rather well-known psychotherapist named Bernard Bettelheim, and he wrote that you can't be a perfect parent, but the thing that stands out in parenting is that you have your child's best interests at heart. And I think that's very true. You have your child's best interests at heart, and you may make some mistakes, but basically you want to give them roots and then wings. And I think...
Roots and wings.
Roots and wings, yeah. And I think some, I mean, I certainly have counseled people that come out of very dysfunctional families of origin, so they don't have the positive modeling. Some may even have been ambivalent about having their own children, but they go ahead and have their own children, and then they often get into trouble.
Well, so kids, kids add a new dimension, and I'll tell you, there's no question that in second marriages, trying to integrate stepchildren from a from the first marriage is the single biggest cause of divorce in second marriages. There's no question about that.
Yes, so, yes, into second marriages, well, there can be another reason, and that has to do, it's sort of hormonal. After a child is born, and then we'll get to stepchildren in a minute, the abrupt change in sexual connection between partners is often hormonally influenced after the child is born.
That's true.
Yeah, because like throughout the nursing years, prolactin production depresses the sex hormones, estrogen and testosterone. And this encourages women from a biological point of view to de-emphasize mating and focus energy on keeping their newborn alive. Yeah, that becomes it's so important, of course, for the new mama.
Well, you know, it's if you're into Darwin's theory of evolution and survival of the fittest, it's important for survival of society. I mean, women have to take childbearing much, much more seriously than do guys who can just move on to the next whatever. And certainly that's one of the things that women are hardwired to do. But, you know, then I imagine that guys can become disgruntled going, well, you know, why aren't we having the sex that we were having before we had this kid? And, you know, they probably don't have the same, you know, hardwired hormonal effect. Sounds like I have read studies where, you know, men's testosterone even decreases when they have children. So to try and keep them a little more in line as well, but probably not nearly as severely or substantially as for females. So the guys sitting there saying, how come I'm not getting laid as much as I used to? And then the next thing you know, you've got that element of dissatisfaction creeping into the marriage.
Yes, of course. It's fascinating how Mother Nature does this from all adjusts hormones so that we can really be fully there for our child. And so you also have in your book, again, Divorce with Decency, now in its fifth edition.
And available on Amazon.
yes, available on Amazon, and that's probably the best way to get it. Of course, when I do the write-up, I always include website, Coates and Fry.com.
But I think Amazon's proving to be the best way to get almost everything in society nowadays. So.
But if any of our, that's really true, anything, including sex toys, I'm just amazed. and lubes and everything. So Coates, CoatesAndFrey.com. And
that's correct.
If people want to learn a little bit more about you, they can go there and also about your book or go on Amazon.com and find it there. You have in some of your facts that 60% of the wives consider themselves, and you touched on this a little bit already, relationship-centered, while only 40% of the husbands do. This can cause a lack of communication, right?
Oh, of course, yeah. That's one of the problems where you begin to see women's dissatisfaction in marriage, you know, creeping in. They're expecting guys to be as focused on the relationship, on the communication, on the commitment to the marriage, on, you know, et cetera, on the children. You know, whereas guys tend to have other focuses, And that is the battle of the sexes or the difference between the genders or whatever. And especially, it's especially true of younger men who have, you know, who really have still got some testosterone and are thinking about all kinds of other stuff, you know, climbing the career ladder, you know, working on their golf game, doing whatever. Guys are schooled to think in terms of different hallmarks for success. And, you know, women traditionally have, you know, the family has been their yardstick for success. Although that, you know, that's changing too. Now women are out there in the career configuration, you know, every bit as strong as men, and yet they're still expected to do all the housekeeping or most of it. And so you can see why women begin to get a little upset by the whole process.
Absolutely, and you no doubt hear in your office from some of these women how unhappy they are and how overwhelmed they are.
Oh, no question. No question. I mean, women, nationwide, women file for 2/3 of all divorces. You would think it would be about, you know, half-half, where guys would be equally upset about half the time, women about half the time, but that's not actually true. Guys won't file for divorce. This is an exaggeration, but an overstatement, but it's largely true. The only time guys will file for a divorce is if they've got their eye on some other woman, or some other woman's, you know, got their eye on them, her eye uh-huh. on them. Guys will stay in even just kind of a marginal marriage without even really realizing it's marginal, because to them, that's all their expectation is, you know, I'm getting 3 hot meals a day and I'm getting to watch sports on TV and, you know, she's not bugging me too much. And then, you know, that's the mark of a good marriage, where, you know, a wife wants to talk about, you know, her innermost personal thoughts and, you know, and the world today and what they, you know, what all of her friends are up to, and society is coming apart at the seams, and why he isn't more enthusiastic about the fact that she joined the Women's March on Washington to protest President Trump. I mean, you know, there's a lot of different angles to be worked at nowadays. And the women are the ones that are the strongest about wanting to focus on that and verbalize those kind of things, whereas guys would just as soon ignore it.
That's so very true. You also have, let's talk a little bit about sex, and you do, of course, in your book, Divorce with Decency, and you say that the California Children of Divorce Project discovered that more than 1/3 of both men and women rank sexual deprivation as a major cause of their breakup. An average had not had sex for 3 to 5 years. I do see some of these couples. They finally get themselves in for some counseling after not having had sex for, sometimes it's even more than that. And as the
Which
person,
is astounding to me.
It's astounding, yes. It really is astounding, because...
But I do. I hear it all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
How long have you been sleeping in separate bedrooms? Oh, you know, 5-6 years. Really? Yeah.
Yes.
So that...
You know, I always say never give up on sex. I mean, ideally, just because intimacy is a bomb, a connector, a place of surprise. It's self-care with help. The redirection of tension into pleasure. I mean, it's such an inexpensive way to manage your stress. And you know, and if people don't have much money, it's homemade entertainment too. And
it's also a pretty good predictor of, you know, how the relationship's going. I mean, it's a great way to repair relationships or maintain them, keep them strong. It's just, you know, and it doesn't have to be rabid crazy sex. I mean, just, you know, just getting naked and holding each other is fine. I mean, you know, the what do they call that? Outer course, right? Instead of
outer
course, outer
yes.
course. You know, so it's a good balm on any relationship. But it's also by the time they hit my office as a divorce lawyer, it's oftentimes the economists say, a leading economic indicator. This is a leading marital dysfunction indicator. If you can't. I mean, people will come into my office and say, well, we've been going to counseling for 3 years, whatever. And I'll go, you know, here's an easy way to try and determine whether your marriage has really got a chance or not. How, you know, what's it feel like to actually make love or be or hold your spouse or get romantic with your spouse nowadays? We haven't tried it in years. Well, try it. And, you know, if she literally draws away and is, you know, repulsed by you, then, you know, then you may have a pretty good indicator that you got a problem. You know, if you can use the physical attraction to regenerate a marriage, then you may have a success story. But, you know, oftentimes, just a picture's worth a thousand words. One little snuggle or one little sexual romp can sometimes be worth at least a thousand words, because it really, it speaks volumes.
It does. It does speak volumes. I like what you say, and I would add one other thing to that, and that has to do with kissing. A lot of long-term married couples, I'll ask them, well, how often do you kiss anymore? And most of them say not very much. So I'll suggest just what you did: get naked, hold each other, snuggle, kiss, and do all of those really good things. And it helps release oxytocin. Sorry about the sirens. I guess you can hear them, can't you?
Oh yeah.
I live down the street from a fire station. And so, it's very, very important to do this, the outer core stuff. I also suggest that to help couples transition from work mode to being at home for maybe R&R, rest and recreation, that they should greet each other at the end of the day with a 7-second kiss and a 15-second hug. And then they can go to do whatever they need to do for the next half hour or whatever to transition, maybe watch TV or maybe read the paper or maybe take a run. But they've set the tone for the rest of the evening with a 7-second kiss and a 15-second hug. And that's long enough to start some oxytocin going, which is so good for the body, oxytocin. And it is in breast milk, too, of course, so it helps the mother and the baby bond.
I had never heard it timed out at exactly 7 seconds or 15 seconds, but it certainly makes sense. I mean, it certainly makes sense, just basic stuff. You know, when your spouse comes home from work, you know, put the TV on mute or better yet, turn it off altogether and go greet them at the door and give them a hug rather than just, you know, grunting as they walk past you and you're still got your eyes, you know, fixed to the latest soap opera. And same thing when you're, you know, kissing each other goodbye before you leave for work or whatever. I mean, you know, that sets the tone for the whole day.
It really does. And if you can have morning sex, that really sets the tone for the whole day.
No kidding. Yeah. And that's, you know, and mornings, as I'm sure, you know, you counsel your patients or your clients, but maybe, again, your listeners may not know, you know, men's testosterone is up to 30% higher in the morning than it is any other time of the day. So,
yes,
you know,
it's
definitely the time to be a morning man if you're a guy, mm-hmm. and having any issues about, you know, abilities to get erect or to achieve orgasm, you know, that's your best shot.
Best shot is in the morning, and I when I suggest morning sex, some of my couples say, well, you know, what about morning breath? I said, well, get up and go brush your teeth, for goodness sakes, and then come back to bed. Or some couples have a little mouthwash by the bed. I mean, you can certainly accommodate morning sex, but you have to have the right mindset, I think, and it really can set a much better tone for the day if you have morning sex, especially if it's accompanied by orgasms.
Yeah, the best kind of sex.
Yeah.
Not the only kind of sex, but certainly one of the best.
One of the best. So you also say that physical and sexual chemistry is better in second marriages, and I touched on one of the reasons I think that's true, and that's the hormonal factor. A second marriage may not be producing children, but of course then they have to deal with stepchildren or, you know, a blended family situation. Brad, can you think of other reasons? I'm sure you can. Second marriages are often a little better.
Well, you know, for one thing, second marriages, you know, they can be better in a lot. You can learn a lot from first marriages and failures in relationships and whatever, you know, probably, you know, at any stage. But at second marriages in particular, if you've had a first marriage that is just, you know, the first girl or guy you ever knew, or, I mean, I'm sure for millennials that are, swiping left or right on Tinder, there's not too much of that left anymore. But for, you know, for us, you know, a lot of times, like I say, you married your high school or college girlfriend, and maybe it was the first marriage you went into, and, you know, you didn't really know that much about other relationships, and maybe the sex part worked out, or maybe it didn't. But by the time you get to be through with your first marriage, maybe your late 30s or early 40s, you know, maybe the guy is looking at for a woman who's 10 years younger. He's more physically attracted to her. You know, maybe kids are the basic building blocks are less of an important factor, and you got more of a chance to focus on, you know, raw romance, including sexuality. You know, maybe women are, you know, priming themselves up to try and move up the ladder and get with a guy and are smart about the way they behave sexually in order to do so. I mean, there's a lot of different ways that second marriages come about, rather than I kind of just backed into it by accident kind of first marriage. Second marriages have they've got a different target rich environment.
Yes, and you have used a phrase that I have used as well, sometimes giving you credit and sometimes not, but it's if you keep your eyes open, you learn and improve, and I think that's so true. But you've got to be aware and conscious and bring some of that learning and improving to a new marriage.
And it's not that difficult to do. I mean, part of the reason why my book is called Divorce with Decency is because I really try to get people through divorces in a way that is somewhat holistic, trying to be as decent as you can to each other, trying to keep the legal fees down and the emotions under control, and get people through it so they can make it a learning experience rather than just this hostile, you know, hate-filled deal where you just, you know, you, nobody learns anything. I find that if you can come through a marriage with some appropriate counseling, both of the kind that you give and the kind that I give as a lawyer, and you know, you come out of it that much wiser, hopefully both of you do, ready for your second or third, whatever marriage, if you've handled it in a way that you, you know, actually grew out of it rather than just repeating the same mistakes over and over again that you made in your prior marriages. So, I've always tried to run my practice that way, and I know that's the way you run yours. So, you know, people are smart. They find people that are like us and that are trying to be holistic in the way that they're guiding them through these, you know, probably one of the most difficult periods in their entire lives, unquestionably. Mm-hmm. And you might as well learn something from it. It's not going to be any fun no matter what you do. So you might as well make it a learning experience.
Absolutely. This is very interesting to me. Sexual satisfaction is one of the best predictors of overall happiness. And yet in one study, only 12% of couples reported not having serious sexual problems. And of course, this helps my profession a lot, only 12% not having serious sexual problems, but this was after having children. So we're back to that child influence.
Like I say, the sexuality is huge, and you know, all the way through. It may get to be huger or lesser depending on, you know, after the birth of the kids. But it's an important factor in keeping love alive, and I think it's one. I don't want to sound like a sexist pig here, but I think it's one that women is especially important for guys. I mean, you know, this may come as a big surprise, but it turns out that, you know, men generally have a higher sex drive than most women. You know, what a surprise. 60% of men, but only about 35% of women say that sexual activity is important to their lives. And again, that may drop to 25% or 10% or God knows what after the woman's had her first child or second child, whatever. And I know lots of relationships where it's just dropped out of the equation altogether. But, you know, women may do that at their peril because guys, you know, women may be able to just go, hey, I could care less about sex anymore, but it's pretty rare that guys really, really go that route. I mean, guys still are fantasizing about it and, you know, talking to the younger girls at the office and doing whatever, trying to be charming or put on whatever, you know, show they can, just like members of the animal kingdom, you know. I mean,
right.
show them your brightest plumage, to, you know, trying to be, mm-hmm. you know, something that's attractive to another mate. I mean, guys, guys are hardwired to do that. And I think when women, you know, make the mistake of thinking, oh, well, sex isn't that important to me, so it must not be that important to him anymore, it may be just that. It may be a mistake.
It may very well be a mistake. And there are even men in their 60s, 70s, and some listeners will find this surprising, and sometimes into their 80s, who, if they're healthy, their libido does not go down. They're still interested. And some of that data came from a study that Dr. Walter Bortz and I did in the early 90s on aging and male sexuality. We spoke to maybe 12 groups of SERS, that's an acronym for Sons in Retirement, and these were luncheons where Dr. Bortz and I both spoke, and we gave out a questionnaire, and we got 1,200 of them back, which is a good return.
Wow.
And so we found that that men, if they were healthy, and if they had an interesting and interested partner, that they were still enjoying a robust sex life. Now, that could be, in some cases, without a lot of intercourse and maybe more outer course, but maybe still with a lot of oral sex both ways. But in any case, they were connecting. I remember reading the questionnaire of one guy who was 91, and he was a healthy guy, and he had an interested partner who wasn't much younger than he, and they were still having a robust sex life. Bravo for them. Bravo. And it becomes then a really important part of quality of life as you age. Now I have my gerontologist hat on, but it's so important to remain sexual for successful aging, and it's so healthy for us. So
well, and I sex is a leading indicator, of course, but a lot of people may have heard of the old business Bible, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was done at the turn of the century, where he was interviewing the robber barons, the Rockefellers, and the Carnegie guys, at the turn of the 1900s.
Yeah.
He asked them what the most important thing in their lives was, and these are guys that are titans of industry that had done, built railroads and banks and oil wells, and the biggest single response was, to please a woman and to be loved and adored by a woman. I mean, guys want women to think they're, Prince Charming. And the physical display of affection, a woman who just hangs on to you. I remember my wife Sachi and I were just recently at a party, and a friend of mine was just introducing his new second wife, and she was hanging adoringly on his arm and stuff like that. And my wife said, oh, gross. And I said, that's probably exactly why she's the second wife. And I don't know what happened to the first one, but that's what guys want. And it may seem silly, but that's what Napoleon Hill found, 120 years ago. And it's true to this day. Guys have this idea where they want to be, their girls, first and last and only love, and just be adored by a woman. A lot of guys turn to younger women for that, and a lot of younger women are smart enough to make that pitch. But it doesn't have to have anything to do with aging at all. It can really just have to do with whether or not you feel touchy feely toward one another still.
I remember reading a quote from Getty. Let's see, which Getty was this? The first one with the railroads. And he said, I would trade all of my money, and he made millions and millions back when millions and millions
when
were
millions
a
were
lot.
Really millions, yeah.
Yeah. He said, I would trade all of my wealth for one lasting marriage that was really good. And because he had a lot of divorces, and it made him sad and lonely.
Yep.
And
no,
guys want to
feel loved, and they also want to feel like they're the knight in shining armor. And that becomes harder and harder to do. I don't know if we're going to have time to get to it today, but part of what's restructured American society is that women are now out achieving men, in a whole wide variety of areas. So guys are oftentimes, you know, making less money than their spouse, maybe have less influential jobs. She's just as tired from her work day as he is. And, you know, and yet guys were sort of hardwired to be the king and the provider and the guy who clubbed the saber-toothed tiger at the, you know, at the entrance of the cave and kept the wife who had just given birth, you know, safe from animals and attacking tribes and whatever. I mean, you know, that the whole dynamic is changing to where guys are no longer in that protector-provider role. And instead, they may be being viewed by their spouses, you know, kind of a loser because they're not doing as well fiscally, financially, career-wise as the wife herself is doing. Plus, she's still expected to do, you know, all the work around the house, which again becomes a little irritating to the women.
It often does. Well, as long as you brought up, I thought we'd save the she economy, the growth, to the next time we usually do part one and two, you and I, in each season of the year. So I'm hoping you can
and
be
you
on.
And you asked me to confirm earlier that August 15th would be the next show, and that's fine with me. That would work great if you want to pencil August 15th in as part two of this
conversation. Let's do part two, August 15th. Good, thank you. So let's talk a little bit about the women's movement and the rise of the she economy, and then we can maybe elaborate a little bit more on it when we talk again on the 15th of August. Still under sex, though, I want to talk a little bit about monogamy. But anyway,
let's stick with that for now. Let's talk about sex while we're on the time. I know it's hard to get you off of this topic. So let's talk about that. You know, and monogamy is an interesting concept. You know, there's a serious question as to whether with this, you know, this whole changing and shifting around where, you know, nuclear families and trying to keep it together for the kids and, you know, nuclear families may be on the verge of being history anyway. And, you know, where does that lead monogamy going? And, you know, does the internet and all this, you know, instant gratification, is that going to tend towards shorter term, less committed, revolving relationships? Because certainly that's what Tinder and the ability to meet matches, you know, instantly online heads toward, instead of these longer-term committed marriages. Now, you know, it's a shorter-term, immediate gratification kind of a deal. So where does monogamy fit into that, you know, to that continuum?
Well, there's all of that, but Christopher Ryan's book, Sex at Dawn, published about 5 years ago, he claims that we are hardwired to be non-monogamous, and he says that of all the lies people tell one another, there is none that is ubiquitous or corrosive to happiness as, he says, as the classic declaration of undying love that excludes all others forever and ever. And he quotes Oscar Wilde, who said, marriage is the triumph of imagination over intelligence. But he says...
That quote's in my book, I believe.
I think it is, yes. You have a lot of good quotes in your book. I'm pretty sure that one's there. That it's not the marriage per se that suggests vanquished intelligence, it's the nearly universal expectation that a happy couple will forsake all others forever and ever and ever.
Well,
and that's a hard thing to live up to for many people.
Well, the whole concept to think, you know, every person on the globe, I found the one woman who's right for me, you know, my soulmate out of all others. I mean, that you know, that almost defies common sense. Just, you know, and it's a math error, if nothing else, because, you know, I mean, there are hundreds of people that you could fall in love with scattered around the globe. It's just that you could never find them before. So you found whoever was the closest and, you know, the thing to matching up with that, and you married them. Now you're able to find, you know, the other 99 people that, you know, might fit the bill or 9,999 or whatever. I mean, who knows how many people there are, but, you know, now you're able to mix and match with a lot more specificity. So it almost makes monogamy seem like an even more far-fetched idea.
Even Carl Jung, in a letter to Sigmund Freud, and this was in 1910, he said, the prerequisite for a good marriage, it seems to me, is a license to be unfaithful. That was quite radical in 1910. Isn't that an amazing quote?
Yeah, and it may be accurate. I mean, there are, you know, you get guys like Dan Savage, who, you know, who may not rival Freud or Jung, but you've heard of him. He's a, you know, he's a,
oh, he's
actually
he lives
a
here
gay,
in Seattle.
He's a gay gadfly about sex, and out of San Francisco, and he's become quite well known. And that, you know, and that's his argument, is that you need freedom in relationships, and that if you're going to have any chance of holding on to one long-term relationship, it's got to include the ability to have, you know, shorter term outside of the relationship kind of dalliances. So, you know, who knows what the answer is going to be, but it is definitely, what we're definitely seeing is that the whole concept of, you know, oh, I found one soulmate and I'm going to be with one person forever and we're going to have a nuclear family and the kids are going to grow up to be perfect and yada, yada, yada. You know, that's old news. I mean, kids are growing up, you know, with all kinds of factors determining their, you know, how they turn out, mostly peers and social media, mm-hmm. as much as what their parents try to teach them. And most of them aren't growing up in nuclear families anymore anyway, because, you know, everybody's getting divorced. So they're growing up with, you know, step parents and whatever. So it almost seems naive to think that some of these institutions that were put in place, you know, back in the 1800s, when you needed, you know, a lot of kids around the on the farm to work as farmhands and can the peaches, you know, that's going to be the same kind of format that's going to go forth in an urban setting where, you know, people don't even bother to, you know, buy houses anymore. These millennials just live in their parents' basement and they don't get, you know, a career. They work at one job for, you know, 6 months here or 2 years there, and they don't bother to buy cars. They just take Uber, and they don't, you know, I mean, it's just, I mean, everything is transitory. This whole, the whole mindset of these, you know, these millennials when they come out is, you know, borders on being that. The rites of passage that we used to know of, you know, oh, I got my driver's license when I was 16, and I got my first car when I was 17. I got out of my parents' house when I was 20, and I got married at 23, and I had my first kid at 25, and I bought my first home at 28. You know, that's old news.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. With the monogamy thing, I don't think it should be so surprising that we crave variety in our sexual lives, and there's a hunger for erotic novelty that is quite normal for our species. When we have novelty, our brains produce more dopamine, which is the hormone of arousal. And so I counsel couples who want to have a monogamous relationship to trick their brains into producing more dopamine by making love in different places, which can be hard if you have small children, different places within their home, like the kitchen counter. They may want to make sure that they disinfect it afterwards.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So make love in different places, and certainly to get away. And one of the best getaway places is your home, formerly my home, Hawaii. Because people then
that's
they're
a good place
in a
to
romantic
make love.
Place.
I can tell you that for a fact.
Yeah, and so they're in a romantic place and they're making love, maybe in a hotel, and that's novelty. They're making love in a different place. So you have to trick the brain into producing more dopamine, which is in abundance along with testosterone in the beginning stages of most relationships.
Yeah, and then unfortunately diminishes the longer you've been in it.
According to Helen Fisher and her studies using, she had access, Dr. Helen Fisher, she was a professor at Rutgers University, and she had access to a functional MRI, and she put couples into the fMRI who were newly in love and then had been together a long time. And what she found is that when couples were newly in love, their brains produce lots more dopamine, hormone of arousal, and testosterone. And that's the stage where you can't keep your hands off each other. And it feels like you're on speed. And you stay up till 3 in the morning talking. And it feels so good. And then somewhere at about a year and a half to 3 years, so she looked at their brains again, or couples exist who were in a relationship for a while, and then they transition to producing more oxytocin, the cuddle chemical, and vasopressin, the bonding chemical. And so then it feels more like friendship. And so some of the eroticism has gone. So you really do have to be very creative if you want to keep your sex life lively. And it's possible to do it. I'm living it. So
yeah,
I know it's
but,
possible.
You know, you're a pro when it comes to this kind of stuff. I mean, I know a lot of people that have, you'll talk to them and I've never really tried oral sex, or I've never really tried, sex anywhere else, or in fact, it's too painful or whatever. I mean, there's an awful lot of people that are just not, they haven't got the skill set totally figured out, and guys are notoriously bad at this. I mean, what are the statistics that, that it takes a woman 18 to 25 minutes to achieve full enjoyment of sex, or orgasm, and foreplay is essential, and extended foreplay is essential, whereas guys, can explode in, 4 to 5 minutes, and then, they think that's their idea of sex. So there's a real disconnect between the genders as to how all this works.
That's very true,
and,
Brad.
And it may be, when you talk about the novelty being such an important aspect of all this, it may not bode well for monogamy. I mean, it may be old news, the same way I was describing the old Donna Reed, Leave It to Beaver type of nuclear family. I mean, those days are gone. These young kids are on a whole different wavelength.
That's absolutely true. I think about it. In the 1950s, people married predominantly for love. And at that time, divorce was still rare. I can remember, that's how old I am, that it was, I remember having one friend when I was in grade school, and her mother and father were divorced, and I thought, wow, that's so unusual. And in the Leave It to Beaver marriage, men and women had separate roles, separate sets of friends, separate leisure activities often. And children were to go out and play, and no one felt guilty about it, right? Just go out and play.
Yeah.
And it was
yeah.
a safer world then, as long as women performed their marital duty, whether they enjoyed it or not. Sexual adjustment in marriage was deemed good enough. So they didn't have the high expectations. And if either partner in the 1950s had an affair, it seemed easier to keep the fact a secret than threaten the relationship. That was all true in the 1950s. Wouldn't you agree?
I totally agree, and I totally agree with your assessment that it's all changed.
Whole
situation has totally flipped around.
Yeah.
And we're in a new dawn, brothers and sisters. It's a whole different deal. And I'm no expert on this. I've been married for 25 years, so I'm not exactly up to speed on internet dating. But when you throw in internet dating on the top of this, where, they've got these apps now that are Tinder coupled with a GPS, where you can literally swipe left and swipe right on a Friday night in Manhattan Island and figure out, who's available inside of 200 meters. I mean, it's crazy.
Isn't that mind-boggling?
I'll be at Joe's Bar on 53rd. And I'll be there for the next 20 minutes with my, and they all rove in packs with their friends. No, that's the other thing. Courtship has gone out the window. Nobody buys a corsage and rents a tuxedo.
No.
And, comes to the girl's house and picks her up and asks her father what time he has to bring her home. I mean, it's all just, hey, I'm going to be with a bunch of my buds. We're going to be down at Joe's Bar from, 10:30 on. Why don't you get some of your gals and come on down and meet us? I mean, it's like, was that a date? Was that some kind of tribal mating ritual? What the hell was that?
It becomes a hookup.
Yeah.
Really.
And hookups are replacing long-term relationships.
Yes, and then...
A lot of people don't even know how to conduct a long-term relationship anymore. They're pretty good at hooking up, but they don't really know how to do what it takes to keep a long-term relationship together. And then you throw in the prevalence, like I say, of online dating and pornography and stuff, which we can talk about later because I think we're coming to the end of this run. But
we are.
You know, it works definitely in favor of shorter term, rotating, revolving relationships instead of longer term, seriously committed ones. You know, because the opportunity cost of giving up on any one potential suitor is much lower than it ever used to be.
Yes, and we will revisit some of this, including some new topics, topics that are part of this whole discussion. But I think it would be good to end the show with some of your future predictions. And you've been, because we've been doing shows together for a long time, many shows in Hawaii starting in 1999, and many shows on Love, Lust, and Laughter starting in, 2011 maybe. So you've been my most frequent guest, and you're such a good friend, too, and so much
and
fun.
And most appreciative. I love talking to you. We used to see each other socially when you used to live in Hawaii. Now all we ever get to do is talk in these talk shows, but it's still it's great to talk to you, and you got great ideas. I'm making notes about the dopamine being the arousal hormone and the Oxycontin being the cuddle and bonding hormone. I pay attention.
Yeah,
while we're talking, I'm still making notes. A lot of the stuff that I've learned from you over the years has wound up in my book. You were the first one to turn me on to Sex at Dawn. The book, not the action. A lot of this stuff we've been great at trying to help each other's careers along and understanding, and
sure.
We've helped a lot of other people along the way. So
it's called inspire. This is what friends do. They inspire each other. They encourage each other. So maybe you'd like to close the show, because we have about another 2 minutes, with some of your future predictions, and we can do it again on August 15th when we do part two. What are some of your future predictions?
Well, I gave a speech years ago in support of Divorce with Decency number 4. I mean, this new volume that came out really just last month is number 5 by the UH Press. And, I talked about 7 mega trends of the new millennium back then, and I was talking about the woman's movement and the rise of the she economy, cohabitation, which is just, living together without benefit of marriage or clergy. And that one we haven't even talked about on this show, but that's a huge trend, too.
Yes,
social media and the internet are obviously changing relationships dramatically. Pornography, which we haven't really talked about on this show, but is, dangerously close to hardwiring guys. I mean, as if guys didn't have enough problem trying to be viable partners already, especially to a class of overachieving women. Guys are starting to look like slackers, and the more porn they watch, everything's starting to go slack. Because
including their penises. No, it's true, and we will get into this next time, because it's a pretty important topic and very relevant. Anyway, what else?
Well, the same-sex marriage that's a huge game changer. Going to be very interesting to see when this all settles out, how many people are going to, what percentage of society is going to be, ambivalent about their own sexuality. I mean, nowadays you can check a box where it says, you're neither male nor female. You're either uncertain or unwilling to commit to either gender. And kids are being raised that way. I mean, we certainly didn't expect that. Anyway, we'll have more time to talk about it later.
Yeah, that's the music. So we have to close. Thanks so much for a great show. Talk again August 15th. Bye-bye.